you think about it, the tech companies who are all going into healthcare now, you know, Google have their R&D facility, they've been doing genomic sequencing. It means that the tech companies have all the data, a lot of data, and we don't.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
My name is Natalie Yeadon, and I'm one of the co-owners and managing directors with Impetus Digital. And so for those of you who do not know what Impetus Digital does, our company has built some of the best-in-class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration tools. We work with pharmaceutical, medical device, biotech companies across the globe to help them virtualize their in-person meetings, be it advisory boards, investigator meetings, co-author working groups, medical education teams. And even since COVID-19, we've helped a lot of teams do things like POA brand rollouts, sales and MSL training, and a whole slew of other things. But more importantly than this, at Impetus, we really believe that everything starts with a thought. And then from a thought comes a conversation. And these are the kinds of conversations that we are really trying to foster using and leveraging our podcast and our YouTube channel. And having these kinds of big, hairy, audacious conversations with the provocateurs and the bleeding edge technologists like the Andres of the world that we have at the table today. And we really feel that by delving into some of these discussions and these ideas, these things are going beyond the pill, that we can all work collectively to truly disrupt healthcare in a positive manner. So I'm so pleased and honored to be able to have Dr. Andre Bates here with us today. So happy. Just a little story. I met Andre probably about, it's a long time ago at a conference. And it was amazing that she actually was participating in an Impetus Digital virtual event, noticed me, noticed our company, and it reunited us. So it is really a small world when you really think about it. So Dr. Andre is a founder, CEO, and a thought leader. She's also the board chair of a company called Ularis. We're going to dig right into that today. Very exciting company. And she leads a global team of really early pioneers. They're leveraging advanced AI analytics, and they're helping pharma companies with a lot of their marketing challenges and solving these really complex issues. She also mentors a lot of AI startup companies, and she helps these companies sort of pave the way and really trying to understand their path into the route that they need to become really strategic companies as well. Andre has a PhD in neuroscience and cognitive science from the Macquarie, I probably did not pronounce that way, right? University in Australia, so you'll have to correct me, Andre. And before starting Ularis 17 years ago, she worked in a variety of roles in medical communications and digital marketing, and she worked in all sorts of places across the globe. She's worked in Australia, Japan, the UK, as well as in the US. So welcome, Andre. So pleased to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's awesome. So excited because you have such a really interesting background, and you obviously started your career in academia. So I'm really curious, you know, if you could sort of pave the background for all of us listening today. How did your journey kind of go, going from academia to consulting to medical writing and then digital marketing and eventually to starting your own company at Ularis? So tell us a little bit about what carved the way for you.
Yeah, it is a bit weird, I realize. So I started in healthcare. I was really fascinated by the brain. I still am. And so I did a PhD in neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience. And weirdly, our lab was using artificial intelligence even back then because we were looking at specific brain lesions and getting machine learning to mimic some of those. And then, I love it. It's fascinating. But what kind of disturbed me about it for me personally, not for most people, is that it was, you know, going to be so long before the little thing I was working on had real world impact. And I kind of think, you know, if you're waiting for 20 years for, to see a result of something, it just isn't something that for me personally was that exciting. So although it was fascinating, I kind of like to see impact from things. And so then I was very interested in business and tech, but I didn't really have a job in that. So I studied marketing in my spare time, but at that time I basically had jobs in a hospital after academia. And then I found a job in pharma, which I didn't really look for. It was a very weird coincidence. It was, so I grew up in, well, I'm from Papua New Guinea originally, but I grew up in Tokyo. And so I speak Japanese. And so there was a job advertised that said they wanted someone who had the PhD in neuroscience with the marketing qualification and was fluent in Japanese. And I thought, I don't care what that job is. That's me. So I applied for it and got it. And that was in medical communications in London. And so that was my first job in the pharmaceutical industry, weirdly working on zidovudine, an HIV drug. And then I did that for 2 years. And then I was headhunted by another firm in Tokyo to leave England and go to Tokyo. So I did that, but that was again, medical communications. And, but what I found with that company was that they were quite behind in terms of digital. I mean, this was of the early 90s, so everyone I suppose was, but in every way. So I went to Tokyo thinking, great, this is going to be so high tech compared to London. And it wasn't, you know, no one had a computer. It was all paper-based. So I, being me, set about to change that. And so I got LANs installed, you know, I really digitized the office. And then I got really into digital for our clients and started thinking, how could we apply digital for client problems? So we did a lot of firsts, you know, we did the first online medical journal in the world. We did a lot of things like that in the early 90s. Then I got headhunted again to start up a digital division of a medical advertising agency again in Tokyo. And so I was doing that and loving it, but I really wanted to add a lot more on the return on investment side. And so they didn't want me to, but I knew it. We had a really strong cases. So I left and started my first company, which was digital marketing, healthcare digital marketing. So I started that in Tokyo and I was really enjoying that. It was good, except my clients seemed to be in New York and London more than Tokyo, so I was flying a lot. But it also got me interested in return on investment, and because everyone always said, what's the return on investment for that? And I always had it because it was digital and you could measure, even though we didn't have sophisticated tools in those days, I always set up the project so you could measure prescriptions. But then I started thinking, well, what about all the other marketing? There's so much money wasted. We should be applying mathematics to all marketing. And so that's what gave me the idea of Ularis, where I thought, I'm going to leave this digital game behind and move into analytics. And I was really in the beginning looking at linear, but I really grew to discover that linear is very limited. And so then I started thinking we need a non-linear approach to do things. And then I remembered back to my university days of machine learning. Hello. So then I started applying that to all sorts of things, but commercial challenges in pharma.
That is fascinating. And more importantly, I think it is so cool that you speak Japanese. We have a lot of clients there. So I will talk to you more about that later. So that's fantastic. Good for you. What a great story. And I just love sometimes the serendipitous, circuitous routes that we can go into in life sometimes, and how when we're in allowing sort of situation, these things just come to us in a very flowing manner. And I really, really love the serendipitous nature of your background. So let's actually linger a little bit more on the whole linear analytics concept. Tell the audience here, what do you mean by linear analytics? And give us some of the background on what that meant when you started Ularis 17 years ago, and then the evolution of linear analytics as we know it today.
Okay, so to anyone without any understanding of the linear versus non-linear thing, you know, linear is really a line, you know, so linear. So you're looking at relationships between data points that are linear, so that, you know, like a line of best fit or a correlation. And, you know, that whole saying that correlation does not equal causation. In fact, there's that great website I remember from years ago, it's probably still there, called spuriouscorrelations.com, which I think it showed things like the number of drownings in America in a year is highly correlated to the number of Nicolas Cage movies that came out that year. So yeah, there's all these things and you go, well, it's not related. I mean, it could be. But so it made me go, we really shouldn't be using linear because it's just, you know, there's so many false positives and false negatives. Whereas, and it's just, you know, points. Whereas with nonlinear, what that means is it can find relationships in really complex data sets. So it doesn't have to be a straight line relationship, it could be curvy, a maze of a relationship. So, and that's kind of, you know, machine learning and all of the AI techniques allow that. They allow much more untangling of relationships between data, whereas linear, you're looking at a straight line. So that's why I was really quite drawn to that.
So you really bring up something important. I actually do a masterclass on something called systems innovation and the whole concept around systematic thinking as opposed to just looking at the functional parts. Can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy on that and how that applies with this concept of multiple causations in a more holistic manner?
Yeah, I mean, I had to systematize things we were doing at Ularis because in the early days, you know, there were lots of mistakes I made that caused me lots of headaches, I can assure you. So for example, you know, you really need to know about the data before you agree to a project. So, you know, we've done projects where we thought we'd have one big data source or two or three big data sources and we get like 150 small data sources. And, you know, those sort of things, you know, you need to know. So in the early days, I made a lot of mistakes like that, which I've learned the hard way. But so it made me realize with each mistake I made that I needed to systematize so that no mistakes could get, you know, we wouldn't have these errors. So I created a process and I don't know how anyone else does it because I haven't worked for anyone else in this space. But I realized for us, what we needed to do was strategy first and planning everything to the nearest detail before we agree to doing a project. So there's always a phase one, and that phase one is always about, and we kind of approach things from the business problem. So we're looking at what is the business problem that you want to solve. And so it's kind of like a consulting approach, I suppose. And then we're planning what's the best solution for that business problem. Well, I guess the next phase we look at is data, because that's the whole thing. What data is there available around this business problem? And I actually have a process for looking at that. And then once we've got the data, you know, what is possible that will solve this problem with that data? And then we kind of use design thinking in the way that we approach this. And then we design an innovative solution, preferably. I like to do things before other people do. And then we plan it. And so we do what I call a roadmap. And I've heard other people use roadmaps, but I don't know if it's the same as ours or not, because I haven't seen them. But what I consider a roadmap is a proper roadmap. So you're really, you've got your business case, you've got your list of your data that you've already looked at and know whether it's feasible to use or not. You've got what is the AI approach we're going to use, because obviously there's lots of different approaches. And then do we need a tech stack or not? Is it just a data science project or a machine learning kind of project? If we need a tech stack, what is the best tech stack? Because, you know, there's new startups in Silicon Valley every day and there's great ones and there's, you know, old fashioned ones, and you just have to make sure you've got the right tech stack and the right AI approach for any problem. And then we look at how many hours of each team member it's going to take and how long, you know, schedule. So it's basically a plan for the project. And so after we do that, either we can do it or the client's internal team can do it, or they can take it to another vendor. But I always start with that, because that way it's never going to be a perfect estimate of what it's going to take. You probably have a ballpark because you really don't know what's going to happen until you start working with the data, but it's going to be a pretty good educated estimate by that stage. Whereas I've had projects where, you know, in the early days when we didn't do that and they've gone so far over budget that I had to personally deal with, as you know, we had to deal with because we hadn't quoted that high. So it's just a good, sensible approach to do it. And
So as I understand it, so you're really working almost like the broker or the consulting bridge between the clients with a real world challenge and these technology stacks or solutions or neural networks or whatever it is, and you bridge that and kind of monitor it. Are you also monitoring the actual execution of the data consumption and evaluation? Is that part of what Ularis does as well?
Yeah, I mean, I am all about case studies. I like results. So I'm, you know, every project we plan has got a results measurement section in it, and how, you know, how that's going to be measured for real results, not just, you know, use, but increased revenue, decreased cost, whatever it is. But for the most part, we did everything, you know, we did end to end. So we did it, but then we did have clients that had a team that they wanted to do it internally. So we're fine with that. And I do think for us, our USP is that strategy, because we all come from healthcare like you, you know, and we understand the tech side. So we're good at marrying the two with something innovative. And of course, that's one of my favorite things is, you know, solving problems in an innovative way. So I think that's kind of the thing that we're best at. I think there's lots of companies that are good at different types of tech. And I am actually in my membership highlighting a lot of those companies. I'm finding best of breed companies in particular areas. So I
think very, very interesting. So let's actually just talk about a couple of really concrete cases. So the ones that are typically come in that people are really bringing to the table, it's top of mind. We talk a lot about this around clinical trials and clinical trials and the need to accelerate regulatory market access approvals. And a lot of this requires data, health data, electronic healthcare data, et cetera. So if we sort of peel away the layers and taking us step by step through the process. So a client A comes to you saying, my challenge is that we need, you know, to get a regulatory or accelerated approval, I need real world evidence. Take us through the process of what needs to be done or what they would be doing typically with Ularis.
We did that project, so I lived that project, so I can really take you through that. So interestingly, with that project, when we did that, they didn't come to us with the problem. The IT team came to us and their CEO had said, we want AI. So they came to us and said, we want AI. And so what we did was that phase one approach, but in it, because they didn't have their defined problem, we got them to interview all the internal stakeholders to talk about their problems. So we understood, so then we got a list of problems. Then the core team, the core client team and our core team had a one-day workshop where we went through the problems and we looked at feasibility. So I'm not a data scientist or a tech person, but I've done so many of these now, I can look at something and say, well, that's going to be a really complex project and it's going to take 2 years and it's going to cost a fortune. This one is going to take 6 months and it's not going to cost as much. So you're looking at what are you trying to achieve versus feasibility in terms of, is it a good, too big a project as a start? And also then data. So in that initial time, we're looking at all of that. And then once the team, and then we vote on which ones are the best feasible, you know, in that example. And we do that even if people have a problem already. We're looking at, there's so many different options you can come up with to solve a problem with AI.
So Andre, I just want to sort of dissect that a little bit. So you're saying you do the evaluation. It sounds like there's an initial, it sounds like one of the challenges is a lot of times people just don't know what the problem is. There's a whole course of action of isolating in this world of complexity, of wiring in and isolating what the key problem statement is. So that's step number one.
That is.
And then you actually said step number two is determining where the data sources are.
So what data sources you need first, actually.
So can you actually explain to us how you help the client determine where their data sources are?
Okay, so if you are saying, I'm trying to think of an example, but say you're saying, I want to increase prescribing after a sales call.
No, we're going to still talk about the case.
I'll stick to the same one. So if we're talking about reimbursement, in this case, the problem was we want faster reimbursement. So, you know, once the drug's approved, we want it reimbursed faster because the process takes a long time. And so we've done this in the US with different formularies, and we've done this in Europe with different countries. And so in Europe, the EMA will approve a drug, and then each of the individual countries have their reimbursement process. In the US, the FDA approve, and the different formularies have their process. So for this, what you are doing is essentially looking for, so the kind of data, I mean, there was a lot of data in this project, but the kind of data you're looking for is, can you have all the dossiers, for example, on previous drug applications, so you can then identify by formulary or by country formulary, which were the ones that got through faster, and what is the difference between the content, the language, all the everything in the application that got them through faster. And now you can make that even more interesting if you can cyber stalk the people on the committee, which you sometimes can. So if you can find out about the people who are going to be on the committee, you might be able to get information online about what their passionate topics are and what they're interested in. And you can actually get AI to write, it won't be 100%, but you could actually get it to write the dossier that's got the right weighting of all the right different bits, but then you are going to have a human go through it and fix it. So it won't be 100%, but it will, you know, give you that kind of that level of weighting of the right things. And so then you do that for each country. But there was a lot more, there was a lot of data. So what we did with that client in Europe, I'm thinking about at the moment, is that we, their internal teams found all the data they had in that space. And then we started mapping the data. So there's a data mapping process. And then of course, once you start a project like that, you've got the whole, I call it data wrangling, like a lasso. So there's that data sorting and structuring and cleaning and, you know, feature extraction, feature detection, and all the stuff the data scientists do to get the data in place. And then of course, there's got to be unique identifiers across the data sets, etc. So there's quite a bit there. I think the algorithms actually are probably a faster part than the data cleaning and sorting and structuring part.
So tell us a little bit, for those especially who don't do this every day, who aren't data scientists. And you were saying that when you're getting into the analysis portion of you know, after the data has been cleaned and et cetera, and then you're actually doing the evaluations and then the classifying and the sorting, and then potentially, like you said, the eventuality of creating an actual document with all of those insights built into it, which is a pretty wow, cool thing to do. What's the difference between, like you said, the tech stacks? What is that? Who runs those? What does that look like? And then what you're saying is like neural network algorithms and software and things. Are they the same thing? Are they different? Can you explain that?
Sure, I can. So I'm not a data scientist or a techie, but I can explain it in a very simple way. So everything's about the data. So the first step is, you know, getting the data scientists sorting and cleaning and structuring the data. But a tech stack is, so if you have a project that is going to be running automatically where the data's coming in, it's sorting it. So there's two types, there's probably lots of types, but I'm kind of classifying projects in this way. There's one that is what I would call a data science project, which is kind of just analyzing something and getting a result. So that doesn't need a tech stack. That needs the data scientist analyzing it and the strategist then coming up with what's, in fact, AI can come up with what it means now. So that's a data science project. You don't need automated data going through. It's the data scientist dealing with it. But when you need a tech stack is when you are having data coming in. It doesn't have to be continuous, but it is going to be more than one batch of data coming in, and you're automating things. So the algorithms are like machine learning, learning from as the new data comes in, they're learning from that new data that's coming in. So that needs a whole technology system to deal with that. So you need a system that can ingest the data and then clean the data and then process the data. And of course, all the algorithms go into these different components to do all these things, but process the data and then display it in a particular way and output it in a particular way and feed it. So it's kind of that whole automated technology. I mean, if you think about, I can't think of a really simple example, but you know, any software that you're using, you know, it's doing that kind of thing in a more simplistic way, I suppose, but it's creating kind of that hardware structure that's doing all the hard lifting of the data automatically coming in and going out.
So really interesting, Andre. So it sounds to me like the data scientist component or that kind of particular project is not a one and done, but it has a very particular output. There's a report, there's something tangible that allows people to make some sort of a decision. Like you said, the use case where you are creating an actual reimbursement dossier submission. So it's an output, it's a thing. Yeah. As opposed to what you're suggesting with the data stack, which is this continuous evaluation, machine learning, process where this is ongoing. It almost reminds me in some ways of the contact tracing concept. It's this continual inputting of data, sorting and determining where the next influx or the next pandemic is going to be taking place. So that would be a concept of something that continues on, like the contact tracing. Is that a correct
way
to
do that? Yeah. And it's interesting because the algorithms used in the data science project can be machine learning algorithms, but it's not, you know, automated. It's just they're applying the algorithms and running something.
So it sounds very complex. And, you know, at Impetus, through our fireside chats, we do talk to people who have some of these really smart algorithms. They're branded. There's all kinds of really neat things. At Ularis, are you working with particular, you know, a mash of algorithms, you know, neural networks, or are you neural network agnostic? Are you working with a myriad of different suppliers? How does Ularis, do you own IP in this space, or are you just working with a series of companies that provide solutions?
Yeah, no, we don't own IP in this space. We give it to the client. So what we have tended to do, and I wouldn't do that if I started another company, is custom build for clients. So, you know, the solutions that we were doing in the early days, there weren't any tech vendors doing them. You know, we started in 2003. So it kind of, in the early days, we had to build it because there was no one else out there. You know, now there is, but in the early days, when we really started to do a lot, we just had to build it ourselves. So I was really quite focused on getting really high level data scientists, high level tech guys. And it was a lot easier in those days. I mean, I kind of basically stole Google guys. It's a lot easier. And I guess nowadays there's a lot more competition for them. So I was very lucky that I got a really good network early. But the way I see it now, I'm less interested in doing the tech build. I'll do it if someone really wants us to do it and, you know, it will be well done. But I kind of think there are a lot of really great companies out there that I keep meeting that do great tech builds, or they have a great solution that is off, you know, already on the market that they've spent 10 years developing, and you're no one's going to beat it because it's so good. You know, that's all they've done. And in those cases, I recommend that the client goes with them if that's the right solution for the problem. I wouldn't recommend a build because it's going to be costly, and there's already something that's been done. It's been venture capital funded, you know, probably subscription now. So, you know, that's kind of where I would, it's, you know, what's the right business case for the client? And so that's basically, you know, in many cases, there are builds out there in these days. It wasn't in the early days.
So we talked a lot about the use case, which is really big around clinical studies, clinical trials, regulatory market access is a big issue. And we hear real world evidence all over the place, right? It's new, but it's not. It's new in the fact that there's new ways and novel ways of getting this information, like, for example, through the Ularis's, as you curate options and opportunities for people to get these things out faster. But what else are we seeing a lot of more in the medical affairs space as it relates to things like data in general? We're hearing a lot about COVID-19 preprints, you know, that were really popular before they came to peer-reviewed journal articles, and there's just data everywhere. And so when it comes down to medical affairs and evaluations of studies and what's going on with your brands and new products and generics and subsequent entry biologics, how can these smart, you know, tech stacks help medical affairs do their work better or different?
I've come across quite a few companies that are specialized in those spaces. So I found one that actually is a scientific AI engine that just basically, you know, finds all the right things and distills it into what is required. But I think the other area that's really interesting in medical affairs is interacting with doctors for scientific information. So I interviewed a company last week that was quite interesting, where they have a chatbot, but it is for lots of different things, but medical affairs is one of the uses of it. And what they can do is it's completely designed for pharma. So it is 6 months to get the build in there, and then to then it's a subscription after that. But in the build, what they're doing is making sure that the language, and it's natural language processing plus machine learning, but you know, the language, everything else is approved, regulatory, all compliant in every possible way, so that the chatbot will never have a conversation that is not the right, you know, an approved conversation. But it also reports adverse events. It does all of the things that you would expect a human to do in a perfect way. So there are amazing advances out there in these spaces. I mean, we tend to work more in sales and marketing, but we have been doing, as you can see, work in medical information and some clinical, but more sales and marketing, I suppose.
Yeah, so sales and marketing is also fascinating, and I'm very interested in specifically lingering on the pre versus the post COVID-19 pandemic issues as it relates to how are people increasing their share of voice in a place where there isn't this new normal. Physicians aren't necessarily seeing people in person. You're hearing more and more about how physicians are reluctant to switch or change or modify what they're doing. And pharma is left in a bit of a kerfuffle where they have their products. They might, some people may even be launching during this period where there isn't any face-to-face and medical education. What are some of the ways that Ularis is coming in with your smart technologies to help people solve some of these big, hairy, audacious issues?
I'm seeing some really interesting areas there. So again, I was speaking with a company that had I've spoken to a few interesting ones, but one that had a chatbot again, that was a physician engagement one, and it was getting over 10 times the engagement that with the physicians than the ones that were pre-COVID, you know, the sales reps pre-COVID. And one of the founders is a physician and an engineer, and he was saying to me, if you think about it, you know, you've got a question for your rep, but you can't, you're rushing from patient to patient, particularly with COVID, you're really in a rush. And so you don't have time to wait for the rep to get back to you, et cetera. You've got to know something straight away. And he said, so using this chatbot, it's the reps in your pocket. You can say, I really need to know about this. And it will logically, because it's a much more, it's a new generation chatbot. So it's got pre-regulated, everything's done. And it can answer intelligently like a normal person would have a conversation. So, I mean, I think those kind of things are lifting the game for Salesforce engagement and digital engagement, as an example. I also had, and I've done these interviews in the membership. There was another one that I find fascinating that is incredible. So they analyze, and they've got this pre-COVID, and you can do it for anything, a language. And so what they do is they can analyze the language from any data source. They can be pulling it in from social media, et cetera. And they can actually get a lot more insights into what's needed than a human can from the same language. And they can do it with market research data. They can do it with so much data. And that one's really interesting because literally it's 3 days to be up and running with them, you know, to get insights. You get insights in the first day, but after 3 days, you kind of there. And it's, you know, and then there was another company I saw that I interviewed, and what they are doing is they have clients that are going old fashioned, old school. I did a tweet about this the other day. So they are using pen and paper and sending things that way, and they're using AI to analyze it all from pen and paper. And they're getting a lot of engagement because most people aren't getting pen and paper. You know, so everything's digital. So they actually got some really impressive results with a campaign they did that was actually an old-fashioned one, but they added AI to analyze and shape the whole campaign. So, you know, you can use AI with paper as well, which is a surprise.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. I'm also thinking about the new normal that we're in and the shifting and modifying, if you will, of the traditional ways that we have been doing selling and marketing. And yeah, one of them that comes to mind is the typical school of sales reps physically being in the presence of physicians and you know, explaining information. Same thing with medical science liaisons. As we know in this time, and unfortunately it looks like there's a second wave, you know, across various parts of the globe that's coming up, this is becoming more and more sparse and you know, detracted. So there's also this idea of e-territories. So I was just curious if there's been any evaluations or data sets or methodologies that you have run across and how people are putting in data to determine where the best ways of allocating sales forces, representatives, because now we're in a world where there's potentially global opportunities because you're not necessarily bound by geography, like physical presence. Have you seen anything like that in your conversations?
Yeah, I actually interviewed someone yesterday that was really interesting. It wasn't for that, but it could have an application for that. So it was just a software that would go and analyze all sorts of things. So pulling in keywords, pulling in time of day, pulling in what kind of engagement in the past, and then basically automatically generating content at the right time with the right keywords, etc., and serving it out. And so I tried it just as a trial, and I tried it with a Twitter tweet, and it was really interesting because the one I wrote got 340 views, the one the AI wrote got 4,900 views, and I was like,
wow,
quite a difference. So I think
and
that,
what was the difference in the tweet? What was the difference in the tweet, Andre? Could you tell?
Well, clearly I could tell from the results. But yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Is there a difference in the wording that they selected? And just were you able to evaluate what words they used that were different?
Yeah, I mean, it came up with about 60 different things that would have that result. And I used a lot of them and got those kind of results. But it didn't look different on the surface. It just looked like something I would write. But it was carefully selected. The words were carefully selected by AI. The hashtags were collected. And even the time, the exact minute it went out was carefully selected by AI. So it was fascinating to me to see. And I'm really enjoying interviewing people because I keep going, unfortunately, oh God, I want that.
That is fascinating. That is very, very cool for sure. For people, especially who are very engaged, and many pharma life science companies are really engaging through social media. So that is definitely, I think, things that people would probably want to speak to Yolaris about. Yeah. So let's actually just spend a couple of minutes talking more about the patient world. We hear and have heard for years and years and years, the word patient centricity. Mm-hmm. But I think in this day and age, especially around real world evidence, and I think especially in light of COVID-19, mm-hmm. that there's been more and more emphasis than ever before about the need to include the patient. Mm-hmm. And I think that's everything because clinical trials can't move forward without having other alternative ways for input to the fact that there, you know, the bridge between the pharma reps and the prescribers has been diminished. So, you know, direct to consumer marketing has really been at the forefront. Mm-hmm. So can you speak to us a little bit about these big, large patient data sets, both in social media, as well as capturing data in things like electronic health records or things like private patient organization, you know, groupings and support teams? How could people navigate that from a smart technology standpoint?
There's lots of ways. Again, of course, it depends on the therapeutic area and the challenge that they're trying to do. I mean, the first thing is AI is about personalization. So patient centricity is designed, AI is designed for that because AI is personalizing everything, be it the message, the timing, the content, et cetera. So you can do all those kind of really, you know, you can personalize even the treatment. You know, in the old days, the dosage was by gender and weight, for example, whereas now with AI, you know, dosages even are starting to be adapted by genetic makeup and, you know, lifestyle and other concomitant conditions, etc. So I think it's the personalization of the treatment, personalization of the diagnosis. You know, there's been a lot of that in COVID times as well with AI, and personalization of information. All of those kind of things. So I think electronic medical records obviously is very helpful, but there are a lot of patient organizations where you can get data. And I have worked with a patient organization that were looking at blockchain to own their own data. And I thought that was really nice. And I think that's the way things probably will go, where the patients own their data. And then if you want to use it, they will give you permission for a specific use case. And I think that's very interesting as well. And that is really patient-centric because they're choosing where they want their data used.
Yeah, I think that's
Google and Amazon. Don't do that.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I'm a huge, huge fan on many ledgers and blockchain and all of that around the healthcare ownership versus sharing and eventually at some time monetizing that. So I think you and I might have had a bit of a conversation on that the last time, but I'm big fan of potentially this being the new UBI. Yeah. So on that note, I was just curious around inputting and the it's one thing about accessing the data. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other thing around inputting of data. So in the past, you know, we've had people transcribe and, you know, everything from medical records to clinical reports and journals to even the way, you know, we're getting retrieving information for clinical trials and otherwise through this actual active transcription and dissemination of data. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts around the future of passive inputting. What does that look like and how are machines going to be involved in the future around passive incorporation of data?
Well, it totally depends on what you're doing and how it can be input, but it just made me think, you know, there's no such need for transcription anymore. That's all automated. Like, for example, you know, in my membership, I do this question and answer and I can, you know, answer questions every week live, but I record that and I'm now using AI to, if someone has a question and they want to see if it's been answered in a previous video, they don't have to scroll through all the videos. They can put the question in the search box and the AI will automatically search through, and there's no transcriptions, but it can transcribe on the spot. And so it will search through all the previous videos, and if that topic has been covered, it will line up the videos at the exact minute that that topic's covered, and you can download the transcription. And in fact, the data scientists on that are working on making it downloadable in any language, so it will automatically translate to any language as well soon. So, you know, those kind of things, and even with that tool I was using for social media the other day, I uploaded a video and it automatically transcribed it and cut clips from the video and used them for social media. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done automatically with AI with a lot of these things as well.
Wow, and that is outstanding. Very cool stuff. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this would love to get their hands on that. So when we talk about these variety, and every day, like you said, there's a new startup, there's something in an incubator, there's something gestating and ready to get launched. Everybody's got some new smart technologies and that are being venture-backed and are coming up every day. It ultimately comes down to the question about how are all of these myriad options, opportunities going to work together? There's always this never-ending question around interoperability between smart machines. Tell us a little bit about how Ularis is trying to help companies solve that, even internally with their own intranet systems, their own CRM systems, and all these different access areas for data lakes. How are they all speaking together?
Well, I'm not a techie, so I don't know the technical details of how that happens, but I think most companies are aware of that issue. So, you know, a lot of them do work. So, for example, if you're using Veeva, for example, for Salesforce, you know, a lot of the AI companies have plugins for Veeva, for example, or, you know, there's a lot of different, There's a lot of different ways that you can integrate with other, with existing systems. So that's happening quite a bit.
Yeah, no, that's outstanding. And I guess just on the point around data as well, it's been one of the reasons why things like contact tracing apps and other things have always been very slow to uptake. That one obviously had a global recognition and awareness. So that's why there was more conversation about it. But it ultimately comes down to is data is the new gold. It's the new oil, right? It's what's fueling the economy. I would hazard to say that it's not just data, but it's our attention. Everybody is vying for attention, which is a limited resource. And then from our attention comes data, right? So which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
So now let's just say it's the data. Ultimately, the question comes down to around privacy concerns about things like capitalistic surveillance capitalism. And, you know, what is happening with this? I mean, I don't want to get into a political discussion about this whole issue around the purchasing of TikTok and what does it mean for people's privacy and shared data and which governments own everything. So how is Ularis helping to spearhead or manage or navigate this conversation about What does security and privacy mean in the new normal? Is there such a thing, or are we just fooling ourselves?
I think we're fooling ourselves, but not for pharma, unfortunately. Pharma do adhere very strictly to those kind of things. But if you think about Google and Amazon and all of those companies, it's very legal the way they use it, but the legal agreement is a 26-page small print document that you just consent to. And everything's recorded. You know, I have an example of a friend of mine who does not hike, but she was talking about hiking boots. A friend of hers was talking about hiking boots, and she'd never searched for it because she doesn't hike. And then an ad appeared on her phone for where to get that brand of hiking boots near her house. And so that was obviously, you know, she said, "My phone's listening to me." I said, "Yes, I'm afraid it probably is." But, you know, everything is recorded, even, you know, the Alexas, the Google Home Minis. They, you know, they respond if you talk to them with their name, but everything is being recorded. So that whole privacy illusion is a little bit more of, it's a bit of an illusion. Not, but as I said, not for pharma, because pharma have very strict codes and regulations. So we have to be whiter than white. We aren't like the tech companies. So yeah, it's that, which is a challenge for pharma, you know, because if you think about it, the tech companies who are all going into healthcare now, you know, Google have their R&D facility, they've been doing genomic sequencing. So it means that the tech companies have all the data, a lot of data, and we don't. So some companies are partnering with the tech companies, like Novartis is partnering with Google. Some companies like Roche are buying the tech companies. So, you know, they bought Flatiron Health, which is the oncology company, AI company. So there's lots of different strategies people are using, but you're right. I think the data is a critical component. I mean, it's like, you know, that I was thinking about this in something I was doing recently where, you know, everything has to be AI first if you want to succeed in the new world. But then what if everyone's using AI? Then how do you succeed? You know, it's kind of, you've got to be smarter and smarter. So you're right. It's going to be about getting the right data that gives you that competitive edge in your projects. And so, you know, we've done for clients data deals where, you know, we can access certain data for the client, but no one else can. And I think those kind of data deals are pretty important for that competitive edge at times.
I love that you brought up metrics, and that's probably a whole other conversation. We're hearing a lot about global move from a typical P&L review, getting away from efficiency metrics to things that incorporate more about resilience. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of AI. I know lots of companies that got, you know, incorporated blockchain into the supply chain process and lots of things around that as well. Mm-hmm. So let's actually just spend a couple of minutes really just talking about Ularis and how people are working with your company. You mentioned that you have and enroll people on a subscription basis. Tell us what the Ularis business model is. Do people work on project specifics, or are you making money through a subscription?
So we started doing just custom projects, and I just got this kind of mission in January this year or late last year where I was thinking, I don't want to just be elitist about AI. I actually would like everyone in healthcare to understand easily, because, you know, it's a critical thing to get. And I think a lot of companies are thinking, I'll leave it to my tech teams. But tech teams aren't strategists. You know, as a commercial person, you have to have a basic understanding. So I was trying to think of what is the best way to help everyone democratize AI. And so I started thinking about the kinds of levels of AI understanding that healthcare have. So I thought there's beginners who really just don't even, they've heard the word, maybe. They don't know anything. And then there's people who they know a bit about it, but they can't figure out how it fits with their problems. And then there's people who've used it, but they've got one gnarly problem they can't solve. And so what I've done with this membership is I've kind of created a success path for these people. So I have, for the beginners, I take them from zero understanding to really understanding what it is, how it can be used. And I take them through from, you know, identifying their own biggest challenge, how to figure out what data, how to figure out what the right solution is. And that's kind of using a design thinking approach. And then really, what are the right questions that you should be asking a data scientist and a tech guy? Because I'm not trying to make them data scientists or tech guys. I'm this is a commercial approach. And then I have a plug and play ROI spreadsheet. So I'm leading them through all the bits that they can then plug and play. And right to the end of that module, that's the first module, they can actually have, there's a presentation that they can plug and play. So they've got their use case, they've got their ROI case, their business case, and they can present it to their boss. But then I take them to the next one, which is the build, and I'm not teaching them to build, but I'm teaching them how to find the right team or the right vendor. And then the next one is scaling, the next level is automating, and the next is staying ahead of everyone else. So for the ones that are informed but don't know how to apply it, they can come in at that, well, which problem should we solve level? They don't need to know about what it is. But even when I'm explaining machine learning and things, you know, I am basic. I'm like, there's all these apples and there's a banana. I mean, really, really simple, because I get it's, you know, the people I'm talking to are commercial. They're not math or tech. So I'm really, but they will understand everything very easily. And it is fascinating. And then I have the last level, which are the people who they get it, they've used it, but they have a problem they just can't solve. And so for those people, I've got a whole section where what I call a game plan. So I talk to Pharma about their problems, and then I find people who have solved those problems with AI and I interview them. And so then I say, well, what was your problem? What was the solution? What result did you get? How did you measure that? How did it, you know, what vendor did you use? What was the onboarding like? How long did it take from approaching them to actually having the solution? And then how were the results measured? And then what was the cost? You know, so it's like within 30 to 60 minutes, they've got the whole solution, even the vendors. And I research those vendors very thoroughly, you know, because I see a lot of vendors saying, we use AI, we do this, we do that. You see vendors saying, I use next best action modeling, and it's really just a rules based with humans, you know, which isn't next best action modeling. So I really interrogate the company. So my loyalty is to the members. I want them to be able to have the best solution. It's not to the companies I'm interviewing. I just want the best companies in there. And then there's so many other things. You know, I am doing live streaming a few times a week. So anyone with questions on tech, strategy, marketing with AI, they can ask me anything. And all of these with the game plans, with the, you know, you can submit game plan. You can say, this is my problem. Can you find a solution? And we do. And then we've got things like free big data. We've got free AI tools you can download and use immediately for things, you know, content writing, etc. And then we've got, what else? Cheat sheets, you know, AI and emojis, just simple things. And then we've also got vendor discounts. So the vendors we interrogate that have solved problems for some of the people in the game plans, we ask them, could we have like a discount? So we've got some project, you know, vendors have given us 30% discount for our members on their tools. Others are giving, you know, free strategy sessions before they get started. I mean, there's a lot in there. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's quite the tool set. So brilliant. Good for you. I love it. And I can see how that you have gone global and there are so many companies that are working with Ularis right now, because that's quite impressive. In the last couple of minutes, I'd love to actually pick your brain, almost do a little bit of some prediction or predicting for the future. With sure. All the technologies that are out there, we're talking about VR, AR. We heard recently that, well, Apple had their big showcase yesterday and releasing a couple of new watches and some new some applications as it relates to oxygen levels in the blood and some new packaging or applications as it relies on fitness. And of course, we've heard the big rave around the Pelotons and the mirrors of the world and all these consumer brand electronics that are coming into the space and gaining a lot of popularity. I'm just curious about your thoughts and predictions for pharma merging business models with the Apples. Apple, of course, has purchased a company called Spaces, which is like VR, you know, and how to use, you know, virtual reality in their ecosystem as well. What do you see as the future with all of this data and everybody's seeking data? What do you see as being the future business models in pharma alongside some of these consumer electronic companies?
It's an interesting question. I mean, in general, I feel like the winners in the new economy are the platform ecosystems. You know, so a platform ecosystem is connecting the different people in the system. So like Uber, you know, they're connecting the driver with the passenger. And Airbnb connecting the person who's got the room with the person who wants the room. And I feel like those platform ecosystems is kind of the future business model that most of the big winners in the AI space are going for. I mean, there's a lot of subscription models for tools. If you're looking at software as a service kind of models, you'll be looking at subscription models. But I feel like pharma actually have a potential opportunity to be a platform ecosystem in some ways. You know, there's a lot of elements that they could start to combine. And I guess when you think about Novartis and Google, for example, when they're combining forces with a big tech company, they probably can do that even better because the big tech company's got all the consumer data and they've got all the scientific and the medical. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in there. I haven't thought through the business model for it, but I think that's interesting. And I think there's so many interesting things that will be coming through. I don't know when. I mean, I'm fascinated by things like Neuralink, you know, the Elon Musk implantable chip. I mean, there's still some barriers with that, but they have made some pretty, if it's to be believed, pretty good progress in what they're doing, but there's still a long way to go. But the other thing that really excites me about the future-ish or not, I don't know, but it's an interesting concept, are digital twins. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, digital avatars.
Yeah, so it started with NASA where they created the digital twin of what was on board the space station so that if it broke down, they could fix it. And then I think General Electric did that with some of their big machines. But there are a lot of data scientists working on digital twins of body systems. And so I kind of see as a future thing, because we've got this with cars. A friend of mine is a mathematician. He used to be a mathematician for Porsche, and he then left and started his own company where they do mathematical crash testing of cars, and they do it for Porsche, they do it for all these cars. And so you don't have to crash test a car anymore, you do it mathematically. And so I have a feeling that human clinical trials will go that way. We won't need humans in the trials. We will have digital twins of human bodies that can be tested in the trial without a human actually taking a drug. And so you'll be able to see how the drug interacts with the body with the digital twin. And I think that is fascinating, that whole space.
We could have a whole conversation, an entire Congress on the exciting things and the idea of 3D bioprinting and clinical trials in silico, which is what you're talking about, and on it goes. It's fascinating. So yeah. I literally speak with you for hours, Andre, but I think we're closing up for the hour, but I would like to leave with the audience here for anybody who's listening to this afterwards is that these are the kinds of exciting conversations that we should all be having in the life science space. What does the world look like? COVID-19, yes, it's been a terrible thing, the global pandemic, but there's also a silver lining. It's been an accelerant and an opportunity for change, for us to consider all of these cool new things. What does data mean now? How do we do this? How do we create new business models? At Impetus Healthcare, we want to leverage our asynchronous and our synchronous virtual collaboration tools to be able to bridge those conversations. Come in and leverage our platform with a series of touch points to engage your stakeholders, physicians, payers, patients, allied healthcare providers, to determine what the outlook will be for your brand, for your franchise, for your company, and what does your company and pharma's new business model look like. So we encourage and challenge you to think about these things, tap into platforms like Impetus, having these conversations with companies like Ularis, and see what the world will unfold. So thank you to all of you for your attention, for taking your time out today. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Andre, you are a wealth and abundance of knowledge, and I'm super excited, honestly, to have a continued conversation with you about how we can leverage your company for the insights that are generated through the Impetus Insight platform. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.